Jewish audio on Kavan.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad of South London, England.
Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to part 12 of this course. This evening, we are going to move on from the period of the destruction of the Second Temple. And in fact, we are going to move away from history in general. It's not very ethical of me to do that since this is a history course. Yet, I'm going to speak about something tonight that perhaps is not so much recorded in the annals of history, but is more in the making of history. Because this evening we're talking about the compilation of the oral tradition. We had spoken about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly. These were a group of 120 great sages, rabbis and leaders who lived at the end of the Babylonian exile and whose members, some of whom were Ezra and Nehemiah, Mordechai of the famous Purim story, and they were at the very beginning of the Second Temple period. In the last few weeks, we have discussed the history of the Second Temple, which is called in the history books the Second Commonwealth, and we discussed and also drew a parallel of the inner conflict, civil conflicts of the Jews of those days to the Jews of our days. We looked at the Hasmoneans and their dynasty, which started with glory and end in dismal failure and in terrible conflict between the people, civil conflict. And we eventually spoke about the destruction of the temple by the Romans. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to start, in fact, the evening by the Zugos. Now, I mentioned this last week. The Zugos, a Zug means a couple. After the men of the Great Assembly, couples of great sages arose who became the transmitters of the oral tradition. Now, I'm going to use this word oral tradition numerous times this evening, and it's absolutely imperative to understand what that means. In Hebrew, it's called the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. What does oral mean? When Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai, he received the Torah in two parts, a written law and an oral explanation. It would be absolutely impossible to attempt to interpret the written law unless it had some oral interpretation. For example, Uchesabtom al mezuzeis Pesach v'Shorecha, you should have a mezuzah. What is a mezuzah? Where is this mezuzah supposed to be? How large is it supposed to be? Who is supposed to write it? What is supposed to be written there? Is not recorded in the written law. This we know by tradition. This we know by the oral tradition. God transmitted that to Moses. Moses gave it over to Joshua. And when we say that Moses gave it over to Joshua, and Joshua to Eli, and Eli to Pinchas, and Pinchas to David, when Pinchas to Shmuel, Yehoshua to Pinchas, Pinchas to Eli, Eli to Shmuel, and Shmuel to David, that was the chain. We don't mean individuals giving it over. It was, in the words of the Rambam, Hu ubeis dinoi, he and his court. In other words, the head of the court, and when I say a court, I do not mean a court of three. This was a court of at least 70 great sages whom had myriads of students of Talmidim. It's just that the Nasi, the prince, the leader, was perhaps the king transmitter. Now, the rule was, and this is the rule that God told Moses, Devarim shebichsav asul la'omram balpeh. Written words, you're not allowed to say verbatim. And by the way, that rule applies even today. You are not allowed to quote verbatim from unknown scripture. Scripture, mikra, which is well known, you are allowed to say because everybody knows it. So for example, if I ask you to say Psalm 145, I presume that most people in this room know by heart Psalm 145 because it happens to be Ashrei. And Ashrei we say 3 times a day. If I asked everybody to read the Shema by heart, everybody could do, because we say the Shema twice a day. We're familiar with it. If I asked everybody to start reciting chapter 15 of Yechezkel, we wouldn't have, most of us, the foggiest idea of what is written there. Even scholars would find it difficult to quote verbatim. And therefore, it's always been a Jewish custom, when you quote something verbatim, or when you quote something from the Mikra, you always use a reference. You always quote it from a text. Or in fact, the great people, this is interesting, when the Rebbe, I've heard him on many occasions, and he used to quote copiously, changed something in the verse, changed a syllable, if you want, to indicate that he'd actually intentionally made the mistake, to show that he wasn't quoting exactly, because to quote exactly you must look inside. That rule still applies today, apart from familiar texts. However, the same rule applied in Moses' days, and for a period of over 1,500 years thereafter, that the oral tradition was not allowed to be written down. It had to be said verbatim. It had to be transmitted orally, and it was not allowed to be written down. Now, that does not mean to say that there were not great individuals who recorded what they had learned. They did. Some of those books we have even today. However, it was never published. It was never made something for the entire people. The tradition was to remain oral. Now, if you have a written text and an oral interpretation, and you are commanded to repeat that over to your children and make sure the entire nation knows about it, you must set into motion an entire infrastructure of Rebbe and Talmud, of student and master, of education. We will see tonight how really structured Jewish education started about 100 years after the destruction of the temple. Around that time, and even before that time, if you think about it, to this country, when was every child expected to go to school to learn until a certain age? It was only in recent times that formal Jewish education, formal education was introduced in this country. Formal Jewish education has been around for almost 2,000 years. And people ask the question, why are we called the people of the book? Now we can understand. Now, obviously, if you have a student hearing from a teacher, each student has a mind of his own, and has an approach of his own, and records differently. And therefore, it's not surprising that down the centuries, there were variations in the oral tradition. And sometimes there is dispute in matters where the halacha was unclear. Let me clarify that word, halacha. We throw it around a tremendous amount. What does the word halacha mean? The word halacha comes from the word halicha. Halicha means going. It is a path upon which to go. A din is a judgment. A halacha is a pathway to follow. A mitzvah, a commandment. And Torah, a teaching. It's important not to mix those words up. The word Torah does not mean law, neither does it mean commandment. The word Torah comes from the word Hora'ah, which means teaching. It's God's teaching to man. Halicha or halacha is the way God tells us to go, the path he tells us to tread. Now, as the oral law was passing down, if anybody had a question as to what the law was, there was always a supreme body which they could go to. These were originally called the Shivim Zakenim, the 70 elders, and thereafter it took on the Greek word the Sanhedrin, the supreme Jewish court. So if there was ever a question of halacha, you went to the supreme court, and the Torah itself legislates acharei rabim lahatos, which means you follow the majority. So if there was a law which nobody knew clearly, then you followed the majority. I'll give you an example of law which was sometimes unclear. A very famous example: is a Moabite woman allowed to convert to Judaism? Now the Torah says that a Moabite man is not allowed to come in the congregation of God. The question was, Moabite man, no, but what about Moabite woman? And of course this was the famous question of Ruth, yes. Was she allowed to convert? Because she was a Moabite princess, and thereby marry Boaz, and of course King David is her descendant. So it was discussed, and Boaz, who was the head of the Sanhedrin in his days, ruled together with the Sanhedrin then that it's only a Moabite man but not a Moabite woman, and the reason is because it was the men who didn't come to bring food and supplies to the people when they were traveling through Moab, when the Jewish people were going through Moab on the way to the Holy Land, but not the women. So there you have an example of a dispute and how it was resolved by the Sanhedrin. Into the second period, second temple period, you had these zugos, these pairs of men who carried the tradition. And where we're going to start this evening is with the pair of Hillel and Shammai, two very famous men. They were in fact the fifth pair of zugos inside the second temple. And if we're talking in terms of history, we're talking in the year 3728. That was the period of Hillel, 3728. The second temple was destroyed in 3828. So Hillel was born 100 years before the destruction of the second temple. So you also have to put that into historical perspective, that they were living in very politically difficult times, as we've previously discussed. We're not now going to go into the history of it. We're going to talk about the compilation of the oral tradition, which kept the Jewish people alive throughout all the centuries. But remember, this was all in a very difficult political backdrop. Hillel was in fact called Hillel HaBavli, Hillel the Babylonian, because he was born in Bavel. Remember, when the Jewish people were exiled to Babylon after the destruction of the first temple, it was only a small amount that came back to Israel and rebuilt the second temple, and thereafter the whole Yishuv in Israel. However, there still remained a sizable Jewish community in Babylon. Hillel was born there. He is often referred to as Hillel HaZokein, Hillel the Elder, not to be mixed up with another Hillel whom we talk about later. On his mother's side, he was a direct descendant of the house of David. His father's side, he was a direct descendant of the house of Binyamin, and in fact, Binyamin, a descendant of King Saul. He came to the land of Israel at the age of 40, and he started, and he learned under Shemaiah and Avtalion. Shemaiah and Avtalion were the Zugos, there was the pair before Hillel and Shammai. In fact, we're told that when he came to Israel, he was extremely poor. He used to earn one tarfik a day. A tarfik was a very modest sum of money. It could be perhaps a pound a day. Now listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. Even then, you had to pay to get into the synagogue, into the house of study. The system then was that you had to pay a nominal amount to get into the Beit HaMidrash. It was considered a great Zechut, and the teachers, Shemaiah and Avtalion, they would get their income from what students would pay to come in. It says that Hillel earned one tarfik a day, half a tarfik he used to pay to get into the Beit HaMidrash, and the other half he used to give his family. There's a very famous story that one day he didn't have even the half tarfik to get into the Beit HaMidrash, and yet he didn't want to miss out on the learning. So he climbed on the roof of the Beit HaMidrash, and he put his ear to the skylight. However, it was a freezing day, it happened to be Shabbos, and he literally froze up there. And Shemaiah and Avtalion, both of them mentioned that it was getting very dark in the room, and it was because the skylight had been blocked by this Hillel. And they brought him down, and they had to, in fact, profane the Shabbos in order to revive him. That's the law, Pikuach Nefesh, to save a life. And Shemaiah and Avtalion mentioned that if a man is willing to do that, to learn, he's worth it, that Shabbat should be profaned in order to save him. It was Hillel that introduced a number of the Midos Shahatoira Nidreshes Bahem. Now this is an interesting point. There are some people who say what's called the Braisa de Rabbi Yishmael every morning. For those particularly men who say it every morning, just before you start the Shacharit service, there is a part of the Siddur called the Baraisa of Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael says there are 13 principles of exegesis of how the Torah is learned. For example, Kal V'Chomer is number one. Kal V'Chomer means if you have a minor case and you have a very difficult case, if the law is applied like this in the minor case, how much more so should it be applied in the major case? That's called a Kal V'Chomer, a light and a more stringent case. So Hillel applied this principle of exegesis right throughout the Bible, and he was very, very famous for deriving things, if you want, putting together and linking up the oral tradition together with the written law. You'll see that was a great theme. This was a great theme. They had the oral tradition, and they had the written law, and many of the sages spent a great deal of time finding what's called asmachta. Asmachta means a leaning, literally, in the written law. In other words, where do we find this written, actually? It may not be overtly written, it may be hinted to. Where do we find it alluded to? He, in fact, after a period of study in Israel, returned to Babylon for 40 years. And then came back to Israel because he was only going to go for a short visit, but in fact the Sanhedrin asked him a question which none of them knew, and he answered with an answer that he'd in fact heard from Shemaiah and Avtalion, and they saw that he was very, very brilliant, and that he had in fact had the full tradition from his rebbes, from his teachers, and they appointed him the head of the Sanhedrin, and he in fact maintained that position for many, many years. He taught 80 brilliant students. The greatest of his students was a student called Yonason Ben Uziel. Now, I'd like to divert for a minute over here. Do you remember me telling you that the first language the Bible was ever translated into was Greek? That was done by Talmai HaMelech, Ptolemy of Egypt, called 70 sages, and he got them to translate the Torah into Greek. It was later, in Roman times, we'll learn a bit later about a man called Unclus, who translated the Torah into Aramaic. Yonason Ben Uziel, the greatest student of Hillel, he translated the Nach, Nevi'im, the prophets, and the Ketuvim, the writings, into Aramaic. But not just translated it, gave a Pirush, a commentary at the same time. And this is known as the Targum Yonason Ben Uziel. We have that even today. That's printed in all editions of the Naf. And it's very important to learn, when you see the word Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M, this is the Aramaic translation. It's very important to learn the scripture together with the Targum. So much so that, in fact, there is a law in the Code of Jewish Law that every single week we are to review the weekly parsha, Shnayim Mikra ve'echod Targum, twice scripture, once verse. In fact, this is something I do every single week, which is, independent of what you're going to hear in the synagogue, before Shabbat, you read through the Sidra, you read each verse twice, and then you read the Targum, the Aramaic translation. The Code of Jewish Law says, nowadays, when many people are more well-versed with different vernaculars in our area, English, then you should at least review the Sedra with the English translation and commentary before you get to the synagogue, so in fact you know what the reading of the Torah is about even before you get that, exactly as you've done it. So it's a translation.
Translation.
Yeah. The word Targum, yes, is a translation. The youngest student of Hillel, he had 80, that was the greatest. Yonas ben Uzziel was the greatest. The youngest and the least of his students was the great Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now, we've mentioned him last week because he was the sage that literally saved the Jewish learning by going to Vespasian and asking Vespasian for the city of Yavne and its wise men. And of course, that was the conduit through which the core of Jewish learning was saved from the Romans. Hillel introduced something called Prusbul. He made many introductions, but I'm picking on certain ones to show how many value institutions he made in Jewish life. Prusbul is made of three words, Prusbuli Ubuti. The Torah says, for example, when it comes to the sabbatical year, you and if you've lent money, then the sabbatical year, the Shemitah, cancels the loan. And the Torah warns against people withholding loans close to the sabbatical year, because people would loan money and then it would be cancelled. So it was in Hillel's days that nobody wanted to ever loan any money. They were transgressing this negative commandment. So Hillel found a loophole. What he said is that the person himself is not allowed to ask for the loan back. However, if he transfers his debt to the Beth Din, the Beth Din is allowed to get the debt back. So he said, write a Prusbul. A Prusbul is a contract transferring your debt to a communal debt to the Beth Din, and therefore you can in fact get your debt back after the sabbatical year. What do we see from here? We see from here where a leader who's seeing the people were not following in the spirit of the Torah, although following the law, this is an interesting point, they were transgressing the law, and they weren't learning. So he found a loophole in order to set matters straight. He had great kindness and consideration for other people, and perhaps most of all, the great middah, the great trait of patience. There are many famous stories about Hillel's patience. I must read out one of them. The famous one is which two people made a bet. One of them bet the other that a lot of money that he could get Hillel angry. He said, I bet you I can get Hillel angry. So he came to Hillel's house on a busy Friday afternoon with all kinds of foolish questions. For example, Hillel, in fact, was in the bath at the time, and the man stood outside and said, Hillel, Hillel! And Hillel got out of the bath and came to answer the door. And the man asked him, why are the heads of Babylonians round? Hillel answered a reason why the heads of Babylonians are round, and he went back to the bath. The fellow, a few minutes later, called Hillel out of the bath again, and he asked him, why do Tarmideans have dull eyes, and why do Africans have broad feet? Every time he pulled him out and asked him a ridiculous question. And finally, the man was so exasperated, he said to Hillel, how many more questions do I have to ask you in order to get you angry? So Hillel said to him, don't be afraid. He said, keep on asking, and I'll be glad to answer you as best as I can. And the man said to him, are you Hillel, the prince of Israel? And he said, yes. He said, I hope there's not many of you ever again in Israel. So Hillel said, why do you say that? He said, because it's because of you I've lost 400 zuz. I've lost like 400 shkolim because of you. Hillel said, it would be better that you should lose a bet of 400 zuz and twice that amount than Hillel lose his temper. So that was one story of Hillel's great patience and kindness and consideration. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, you of course know the story of the man who stood on one foot twice. I have asked that as a quiz question. Who was the man who stood on one foot twice? That was the man, of course, who came to Shammai, the proselyte, and he said, please teach me the entire Torah standing on one foot. And Shammai pushed him away with the building rod. He had like I think it was like a level, you know, like a level, a spirit level. He pushed him, he had his... Why Shammai was then holding a spirit level was very interesting. The Rebbe has a whole interpretation of it, because he was very exact. He wanted the building to be built exactly, and by him everything was done in a severe and a straight way. Hillel was much more open when he came to Hillel. Of course, Hillel said to him the famous words, Madasoni loch lechavroch loisavid, what you don't like done to you, don't do to somebody else. That's the entire Torah. The rest is explanation. Now go and learn it. His contemporary, of course, was Shammai, a great contemporary of Hillel, and the both of them had many differences of opinion, although it's interesting that only three issues are disputed between Hillel and Shammai themselves. In the 100 years after the death of Hillel and Shammai, they were such great spiritual, had such great spiritual influence on the people, that dynasties of students after them took on their names. So you were either a student of Beis Hillel, of the house of Hillel, or Beis Shammai, Lehavdil Elef Avdolos, to separate in between the two. God forbid, one should never quote me on mixing these two, but you could possibly say that one went to Oxford and one went to Cambridge. Two great universities, however, two different ways and of studying. Hillel and Shammai, two great stages, two different methods of interpretation. Hillel was much more lenient in his rulings, Shammai was much more severe in his rulings, and the Talmud in fact reckons out only 18 cases in which the ruling follows the house of Shammai, whereas in all other cases it follows the house of Hillel. Of course, the famous dispute you all know is on Hanukkah, whether we start one candle going up to 8, the view of Hillel, or start at 8 going down to 1, the house of Shammai, and of course we follow the house of Hillel. However, the sages do tell us, Ezehi machlokes shehi l'shem shamayim, what is an argument for the sake of heaven? This is the argument between Hillel and Shammai. The arguments which they had were not egotistic arguments, they were not selfish arguments, but they were arguments for the sake of heaven. Such arguments will and can stand. Hillel had a great grandson who was called Rabban Gamliel Hazokain. He lived at the time of Caligula, the Emperor Caligula, and he died 18 years before the Churban. He also made many interesting takanot, many interesting institutions. The reason I'm mentioning his specific name tonight is because in the papers at the moment, the hottest issue on the front pages of the Jewish tabloid press is the Aguna issue. And Aguna is a woman whose husband either has deserted her, or in olden times most commonly had gone missing, and since she hadn't got a get from him, she couldn't get remarried. Now, how many witnesses do you have to verify the death of a husband? Biblically, it's necessary, one could argue, to have two, as in any other major areas. The Torah says numerous times, al pi shnayim edim, that things happen only with the verification of two witnesses. However, it was Rabban Gamliel, a grandson of Hillel, who made mipnei tikkun ha'olam, he says, because this is such a rampant, and remember, in the time that they were having it, thousands of Jews were being crucified and thousands of Jews were being murdered by the Romans. At those times, people were going missing left, right and center. He made, and he said, that we may be lenient and rely on a reliable, one singular witness in order to allow an aguna to get remarried. In those days you had a man called Rabbi Yehoshua ben Gamla. His name is very important. You've probably never heard of him, but he's a very important man in Jewish history, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Gamla. He was the man that instituted, as I mentioned beforehand, formal education. Now, it's interesting, let me tell you the following. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, which years are the most important years in a child's education? Between which ages? The most important?
Below 7.
Up to 7, that's your opinion. Any other opinions? The most important years?
4 to 10.
Says the Shulchan Aruch, from the ages of 16 to 24. it's quite obvious as well, because then a person's got a mind of their own, and in general, the world, what do they call the Weltschauung, the world hashkafa that you have between those years will give you a direction in life. That's why gap years are so important, yeshivas are so important, and at that particular time, that sets you up for life. Until how old, according to the code of Jewish law, is a father obligated to support his child? Yeah, I think they'll be missing. The halacha says till the age of 6. Okay? Then, till the age of 6. Then, after that, if you want to get an education, if a father can afford it, he can. If he can't afford it, it's not obligated. The child can go and work, and so on and so forth. A girl is different. A girl, you're obligated, in fact, till she gets married. But then they used to marry young. It was, and the what happened was, however, that Rabbi Yeshua ben Gamla changed things, because he instituted that children from the age of five, six, should go to a school, an actual institution, and that the community be responsible for paying for that education. Now that was a major innovation. Usually it was the parents' obligation to put and to take the obligation away from the parents, to put it onto the community, and say it to every child. This happened by 2,000 years ago in Judaism. And ever since then we have had a cheder. It's not always been sophisticated, not always do we have Pentium 2s. We've ever had Pentium 2s in cheder. I had Reb Moshe Katzenellenberg, and there's a chassidish yid. He sat for many years in prison in Siberia. He came to visit where I was once teaching in a class. And he came in and he's looking around, and I was doing something on a computer. So he says, "Vazidus, what's this?" So I said, "Well, we're teaching the kids how to do it." He says, "In Rusland, I'm in the Nishnishkehat." He said, "We didn't have this in Russia." You know, they just had the bench and the teacher. That was it. That's all they had. But the institution of a cheder, that we've had for thousands of years. Three people lived for 120 years. Who were they? Moshe? No, Methuselah lived for a lot. How long did Methuselah live for? 969 years. He was the long man that lived. He lived the longest. Three men lived for 120 years. Moshe, Ezra lived for exactly 120 years, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Those three people. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, we've discussed. He was stole out of Yerushalayim. He went to Yavne. He had five outstanding students. And in fact, in Pirkei Avos, we'll discuss what is the ethics of the fathers a little later. But in the ethics of the father, there we are told of the greatness of five of the students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. In fact, he asked them, what is the greatest character trait that a person could have? Is it a lev toiv? Is it a good heart? Is it a chaver toiv? Is it a good friend? Is it a shochin toiv, a good neighbor, and so on and so forth, as recorded over there. Rabban, what happened throughout the period of the Second Temple was that there was a succession of nesim, of princes, great rabbis who had academies, who gave the tradition over to their students, all of whom were obsessed about education. And all this was going on under persecution. In fact, let me mention it at this stage in the talk. If you make a cursory study of Jewish history, you'll actually throw up the following phenomenon. After the periods of greatest destruction have been the periods of phenomenal growth in Torah study. Let's delineate three times in Jewish history of great destruction, if we can say the period of the Second Temple, the Crusades, and the Holocaust. What happened after the destruction of the Second Temple? We'll soon learn the entire oral tradition was transcribed. and a huge amount of learning went on. What happened at the times of the Crusades? You had at the very time of the Crusades, you have some of the greatest Jewish minds that's ever lived, and the most prolific writers, Rashi, Rambam, the Tosafists, Ramban, Nachmanides, a great spurt of Jewish learning. And since the Holocaust, due to modern technology, you've had in history never a time when that number of books have been printed. The number of Jewish books that have been printed since the Holocaust far surpasses the number of books that were ever printed in history, and the number of people studying today far surpasses the numbers of the numbers of people that have ever studied in one form or other. So that's a fascinating observation. Perhaps following on from the verse in the Torah, the more you oppress them, the more they will rebound, the more resilient they will become. The longer you cook the egg, the harder it will get. There was one of the great leaders called Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. I wanted to mention him because we do mention him on the Seder night. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, I'm like a man of, how old? What does he say on the Seder night? I'm like a man of 70 years old, and I never merited to where's the biblical derivation of mentioning Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus of Egypt at night. And we told this whole narrative how the Chachomim were sitting in Bnei Brak and he was amongst them. This Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah was an interesting character. He was very young when he took over as Nasi. He in fact was 18 years old, and he said, I'm like a man of 70, because a beautiful story took place that everybody came to him and they wanted him to become the head of the academy, and he said, I'm so young. So he did, says the Talmud, a thing that all good Jewish husbands should do, imlich bidvishu. He asked his wife what to do, and she said to him that she doesn't think it's a good thing that he becomes the head because he doesn't have a white beard. That night he went to sleep, and in the morning he woke up with 18 rows of white in his beard. In other words, he became like an old man. That's what he said, I'm like a man of 70, because he actually looked very, very old, because he'd asked his wife and that's what happened to him. Perhaps the greatest of these Tanoim, these compilers of the Mishnah, the book which we'll talk about soon, but the transmitters of the oral tradition at this period of history, was the great Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva lived at the time of and just after the destruction of the Second Temple. Numerous stories are told about Rabbi Akiva and the destruction. One famous story of how he was looking at the destroyed Temple Mount together with his friends, and they burst out into tears, and he burst out laughing. In fact, they saw a fox running over the Temple Mount, and they said to him, Akiva, why are you laughing? And he said to them, why are you crying? Because you always answer a question with a question. So they said, we're crying, it's quite obvious because the temple has been destroyed, but why are you laughing? He said, because if the prophecies of doom and destruction have been fulfilled, then also the prophecies of rebuilding will also be fulfilled. So now we've witnessed the prophecy of destruction, we can also now witness the prophecy of rebuilding. And in fact, one could say that Rabbi Akiva was a great messianic Jew, in the sense that he was a fervent believer that somebody would come and redeem the Jews from the great oppressors, from the Romans. And he saw the Redeemer, the Mashiach, in the form of a man called Shimon Bar Kaziba, to whom he applied the verse, Vadorach Koichav Meyakov, a star shall shoot forth from Jacob, and he renamed him Bar Kochba. Bar Kochba means the son of a star. Okay? And he thought, because he was a very brilliant general, that perhaps Bar Kochba was going to be the one to redeem the to redeem the Jews. However, as we know, that unfortunately England has got something to do with it, Great Britain over here, because historically, let me just tell you, the Roman general who destroyed the temple was Titus. After he left, others, there was a succession of Roman emperors who took over. Some were better, some were worse, but a real baddie to the Jews who took over was Hadrian, and Hadrian, who built Hadrian's Wall. And Julius Severus, who was the former governor of Britannia, was one of Hadrian's biggest generals, and it was him that Hadrian sent to quell Bar Kokhba's rebellion. He brought a huge army to the Holy Land and cornered, if you want, Bar Kokhba in the town of Beitar. And Beitar, which was a huge city, was destroyed by Hadrian on the 9th of Av, exactly the same day, 65 years later, after the Second Temple had been destroyed. In fact, 500,000 people died at the destruction of the Beitar. It was, says the Talmud, a destruction of similar proportions to the destruction of the Temple. And the Romans made a decree that the bodies of the dead were not allowed to be buried. And a miracle happened that these bodies did not decompose. The Romans said these bodies are not allowed to be buried, they must leave them where they are, and they stayed like that for 18 years. The Romans didn't allow any of the bodies of Beitar to be buried. Only after that did they allow burial. And in fact, the fourth blessing in Birchas Hamazon, in benching, the rabbis instituted it as a commemoration to the death and the miracle of Beitar. I always bring this point up of Beitar. First of all, it's an interesting point. Many people don't know the history of the city, history of the fact that there was a terrible destruction equal to that of the temple. But the point that I'd like to bring up more than anything is that what happened in Beitar was a miracle within destruction. 500,000 people were killed, and yet their bodies didn't decompose. It was a sign, if we want, that even amidst destruction, God never abandoned us. The nations of the world are always keen to prove that God has abandoned us. Perhaps the Christians, more than any other, want to show, because their whole ethos is based that God has rejected the Jewish people. In fact, the Gulf War recently was the biggest smack in the face, because it openly showed that God hadn't rejected the Jewish people, that they are still the chosen people. And that destruction of Beitar also proved that, although it's ironical that the miracle happened after such a great destruction. Let's go back to Rabbi Akiva for a minute, to his personal life. Sorry, he was a shepherd for the first 40 years of his life, totally ignorant. There was a wealthy man in Jerusalem who was at the time of the destruction. He was called Ben Kalba Sabua. A Kalba Sabua means a satiated dog. And the reason he was given such an illustrious name is because he had a restaurant, and anybody who was hungry could go into that restaurant to eat as much as he wanted to, didn't have to pay for it, and came out smacking his lips as a dog would smack his lips, and therefore he was called Ben Kalba Sabua. He had a daughter called Rachel, and Rachel, of course, was one of the finest princesses of Jerusalem, and I'm sure Kalba Sabua was looking for a, you know, Rockefeller shidduch for her, and she took a fancy in one of his shepherds, who happened to be a shepherd called Akiva. In fact, his father's name was Yosef, Akiva ben Yosef, and his father was a Ger Tzedek. His father was a proselyte. So Akiva came from Ben Gerim. He descended from Gerim. And she took a liking to him and basically eloped with him in a kosher sense, that she asked him, she saw greatness in him, she realized greatness, and asked him that he please go away to study at an old age. He was very reluctant to. He thought, how could he change his ways? He was already 40 years old. There's a famous story of how once he observed a water fountain that was trickling, and he looked at the stone upon which the water had been falling onto, and a little hole had been formed in the stone. And he thought to himself, how did the water form the hole in the stone? And the answer is that for many years it had dripped and dripped and dripped, and finally it had made a hole in the stone. And he thought, well, if a drip of water can make a hole in the stone, then surely the Torah can make an imprint on my mind. And he went away to study. He came back 12 years later, and he neared his home, and he overheard a conversation before he'd actually walked in. He overheard a conversation between his wife and a neighbor, and his neighbor, a neighbor was chiding his wife, saying, you're a meshugana, your husband's left you for 12 years, you were the daughter of Kalba Sabur, the richest man of Jerusalem, you've swapped wealth for rags, what do you do this for? And she said that if he would walk in right now, I would tell him immediately to go back and study for another 12 years. And without walking in, he went back and did that, because he took it as a sign of permission for her, from her, that he could do so. And at the end of 24 years away, he came back with 24,000 students at his feet. And when he came to the town that she was in, she, of course, was among the throng of people who rushed to see him, and she ran before him and she threw herself at his feet. And of course his students wanted to take her away. Who is this crazy lady who is throwing herself at Rabbi Akiva's feet? And he said, leave her. He made one of the famous quotes of Jewish history by saying that Shali v'shalachem shalahi, what's mine and what's all yours is hers, belongs to her, because she had the great insight of sending me to study. So that was one of the great women of Jewish history, Rachel, who saw greatness in Rabbi Akiva. Unfortunately, the Romans and Roman persecutions didn't allow Torah learning to be done publicly. He went underground and finally died a martyr's death. Can I just go back to Bar Kochba just for one more minute and say one more point about him? Rabbi Akiva actually thought that he was the Mashiach, and at a later stage he backed him initially, which was against the advice of many of his contemporaries, because a lot of the people went to fight with Bar Kochba, but Bar Kochba was suppressed by the Romans, and a messianic hope was also suppressed. So Rabbi Akiva, although he always was regarded as the greatest of sages, had great personal tragedy in his life. There's a verse I'd like to teach you. V'zorach Hashemesh uba Hashemesh. The sun sets, or actually a little translation, the sun rises and the sun sets. But the way I wanted to say it in this way around is the sun set and then the sun rose. The Talmud says, whenever a great person dies, another one is born. On the day that Rabbi Akiva died, was born a man called Yehuda, a baby called Yehuda. And before I tell you a little bit more about Yehuda, I'd like to come back and do a little bit of history with you, because this Yehuda, we're going to be preoccupied with him a little bit, because this was the famous Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince, the author of the Mishnah. Let's just go back into history. You remember I told you about Hadrian? Hadrian's sister was the mother of Uncles. Uncles, the one who wrote the translation of the Torah, was in fact a Roman, and he converted to Judaism and in fact wrote a commentary on the Torah. Hadrian began unprecedented persecutions of the Jews. He dissolved the Sanhedrin. He banned the Torah learning. It was during his times that there were these 10 great sages were killed. And it was only after the death of Hadrian that was a little bit of respite under a Roman emperor called Antoninus Pius, where the scholars in Israel had then assembled in a place called Usha in a town which is in the Galil. Now, there's a very interesting story about the birth of Rebbe, the birth of Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince, and Antoninus. And the story goes like this, that the father of Yehuda Hanasi, who was called Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, his wife gave birth to Yehuda at a time when the Romans had banned circumcision. And Rabban Shimon Gamliel publicly took his son Yehuda and circumcised him. And the Romans heard about it, and they came to take the baby and the father to the emperor, to the governor, and show that the baby was circumcised, and that being the case, immediately the baby and the father and whoever else would be killed because they'd transgressed the ban. The night before they actually went to the governor, Mrs. Reverend Shimon Gamliel got into conversation with a Roman woman who had also had a baby 8 days ago. And these two became very friendly, and she told her the problem, what was going to happen tomorrow. So this Roman lady says, well, look, you know what to do? Tomorrow when you go before the governor, instead of taking your son, take my son. Which she did, and the governor looked and he saw that the baby was not circumcised, and of course they were let off. So at the very outset, this other baby had saved the life of Rabbi Yehuda, or who was related to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. That baby grew up to be Antoninus, the Emperor Antony. Now there was a great friendship that existed between Antoninus and Rebbe. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Just before I get on to Rebbe, I want to tell you about two more people. One of the great students of Rabbi Akiva was a man called Rabbi Meir. Now, if you've been to Tiberias, there's a tomb which you can't miss in Tiberias. It's called the tomb of Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes. And if you ask many people, what does Bal Hanes mean? They'll tell you it's Rabbi Meir, the miracle worker. Which miracle did Rabbi Meir work? It's so folklore and legendary ingrained, people go there to pray for many things, and they'll in fact, even today we know in our family we have a tzedakah pushka, a tzedakah box, which the tzedakah goes to an institution under the name of Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes, and we know that if you've lost something in the Dubov household, you got it, you put a penny in the pushka and you say, Elikad Rabbi Meir Aneni, the God of Rabbi Meir should help me find this thing, and hey presto, 5 minutes later, you find it. So if you've ever lost something, put a penny in the pushka Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes and you find it. Who was this Rabbi Meir, and what was the Ness? Rabbi Meir was one of the students who received smicha from Rabbi Akiva. Let me just tell you what this word means. Smicha literally means laying your hands upon, or resting upon. This was the ordination, rabbinic ordination, that had started from the times of Moses. The smicha that we have today is not the smicha that we have then. The smicha today means, if somebody says, have you got smicha? What it means is, have you been tested on the areas that a rabbi should know today? Granted, that's not the smicha that was then. The smicha that was then was that if you had smicha, it means you were fully ordained by a sage to become part of the legislative process, to receive, if you want, the full, to become a transmitter of the tradition. A rabbi who has smicha today is a person who can tell you what the law says, but he's not a lawmaker. Whereas those lawmakers, the people who had the original smicha, they, called Reb Meir did, he fled to Babylon under Hadrian, and he came back to Usha. He was ordained as the Chacham. In fact, he was one of the very first people who got the title Chacham. That's where the Sfaradim get it from. They don't call their leaders Rebbes or chief rabbis. They call them Chachams, and that came from them. Reb Meir was one of the great contributors to the Mishnah, which we'll talk about in a minute. And finally, one more personality I want to talk about before we get on to the Mishnah was Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. I'm sorry, I'm jumping, I've missed something else. I want to tell you about Rabbi Meir Balanes. Let me come back to Rabbi Meir Balanes. Rabbi Meir had a very sharp wife. She was called Beruria. Beruria. You ever heard about her?
Yes.
Very sharp lady she was. A rabbi was once traveling on the road and he came across Beruria, and he said to her, could you please tell me the way to Lud? And she said, idiot! She said, what have I done wrong? So she quoted to him, it says in the Mishnah, Al tarba sicha imaisha, don't have a lengthy conversation with a woman. You should have just said, Lud, and I would have pointed the way. That was the type of woman she was. That was brilliant. Anyway, the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradian, who was one of the great sages, she was once walking in front of a number of Roman soldiers, and she was walking in a rather immodest manner, and the Roman soldiers did what Roman soldiers would do. They basically imprisoned her. And Reb Meir was desperate to try and get this girl back. So he went to the place that she was imprisoned. And he offered the guard a sum of money to allow her out. So the guard said, no. He said, I can't give you that. If I let her out, they'll feed me to the dogs. So Reb Meir said to him, don't be afraid of the dogs. He said, it's easy for you to. He said, look, you'll see, all you have to say is, Elakad Rabbi Meir Aneni, may the God of Rabbi Meir answer me, and you won't be hurt by the dogs. So he said, you know, tell me another one. He said, do it, bring the dogs. He brought the dogs, the Alsatians, and he set them on Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir said, Elakad Rabbi Meir Aneni, and nothing happened. The dogs licked his feet. So the guard was so impressed, he took the money, he let the girl out. And Taka, that's what happened when they found out who had let the girl go. They set the dogs on him, and he said, Alakad Rabbi Meir Aneini, and nothing happened to him. And everybody called it a Nes. He became known as the Baal HaNes, as the Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes. And his tomb is in Tveria. He's buried, in fact, near, or I should say, Rambam, Maimonides, is actually buried near Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes. And anybody who goes there should go and visit these people. The only other person who lived in this area, by the way, if you've noticed, geographically, we've actually moved to the northern part of Israel because the sages were centered around Tzipori, Usha, which is all in the Galil now, because Judea itself had been decimated by the Romans. In Miron is buried a man called Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, perhaps one of the greatest enemies of the Romans. Even in good times, even when the Jews had respite, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai fought against the Romans. And in fact, the Romans chased him so much, he ended up hiding from them for 13 years in a cave, where he buried himself up to his neck in sand and studied Torah with his son Elazar the entire day, and he was supported by a brook of water and a carob tree just outside the cave. He was famous not only for his opposition to the Romans, but most importantly for a book which he wrote, the Book of the Zohar. He wrote the earliest Kabbalistic text, although that itself is disputed, because have you ever heard of the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Formation? According to some people, that was written by Rabbi Akiva. But Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, he got his fame in history because he wrote the famous Kabbalistic work Zohar, and his Yahrzeit, which is the 33rd day of the Omer, Lag BaOmer, is celebrated even today. I personally have been to Miron on Lag BaOmer. You have thousands and thousands of Israelis, totally secular, mainly Sfaradim, going there. They know one thing, it's the Hilulah de Rashbi. It is the wedding, it's the Yahrzeit of the Rashbi, and they have bonfires. It's a carnival, a tremendous carnival atmosphere. A beautiful atmosphere on them. And you can have, well, Chassidim don't cut the hair of children, of boys, till the age of 3, and they, some of them leave it after till Lag Ba'omer, to go and give the children their haircut then. Because why did they do it? Till the age of three, then when you give the child a haircut, you leave the payas. You leave the payas. But you're not supposed to cut the hair above the bone, over here. So at the age of three, they allow the child to grow the hair. And then have an opsharanish, leaving the payas. Now, I know time is late, but I'd like to speak a little bit about Rabbi Yehuda Anossi. He was perhaps the greatest of the Tanoim, the contributors towards the Mishnah. Now I'll tell you what the Mishnah is. A little bit about the man first. The Talmud says about Rabbi Yehuda Anossi that from the days of Moses till the days of Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, Judah the Prince, there was never a time when you had wisdom and greatness all in one place. Where you had a man of immense wisdom and of great power and wealth all in one place, you had it by Rebbe. Now, when I say the word Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Judah the Prince, is known by three names. Rabbeinu HaKodesh, our holy teacher. Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Judah the Prince, or just simply Rebbe. In fact, the Talmud always refers to him just as Rebbe. He is the Rebbe. Who was that? That was Judah the Prince. The Talmud says he was so wealthy. By the way, he was very friendly with this Antoninus, with the Roman Emperor at the time, because they have this early connection which they had, and they often discuss matters. On his table, you had vegetables the whole year round. He was very, very wealthy. He used to say there was more gold in his stables than there were in the storehouses of the king of Persia. On the day he died, mind you, he lifted up all his 10 fingers and he said, I haven't benefited from this world, not even a little finger's worth. The reason he amassed this wealth and power was to, not for self-aggrandizement, but in fact to cement the position of his leadership, whereby it was so well respected both by the Romans and most importantly by the Jews, that his magnum opus, what he wrote, was universally accepted. What did he do? He saw the following. There is a verse in Psalms which says, Eis lasos l'Hashem heferu torasecha. There comes a time to do for God when you must annul God's law. In other words, in order to preserve the law, you have to break the law. Now that's a very, not everybody can manipulate that verse to their own means. You know, a person might think, in order to preserve it, I can decide to do what? You can't do that. The greatest of rabbis, they are allowed to use that when needed. And he did. Which law did he break? He broke the law that the oral tradition should never be written down. Because he said what's happening is, although now in his particular period, there was a period of a little bit of respite from the Romans, however, whereas in previous bygone years, there were thousands of students studying in great academies under thousands of leaders, the number of students had diminished and the number of teachers had diminished. And now the oral law was becoming forgotten. And unless he recorded it, it would be forgotten forever. So there came a time to do for God where you have to annul God's Torah. God's Torah. God said, don't write it down. And he said, I'm sorry, but if you want to preserve it, we must write it down. So he wrote it down. And he wrote it down in the first book ever of oral tradition, and that book he called the Mishnah. The Mishnah means literally a repetition or a review of the oral tradition. He wrote it extremely concisely. I once compared it to Lavdil again to the Oxford Dictionary and the Concise Oxford Dictionary. The Concise Oxford Dictionary is an abridged version. The Mishnah is very small compared to all the latter commentaries and the Talmud, which we'll speak about probably next week, of how that developed. However, the Mishnah was the first book, and the Mishnah is still today the beginning point of any serious Jewish student. That is the first book you pick up. Children at a very early age today study Mishnah. In fact, it's customary, Mishnah has the same letters as the word Neshama. It's customary to study Mishnah after a departed one's soul. Let me teach you two very important words. Tanoim and Amoraim. Tanoim were the compilers of the Mishnah, the people who contributed to the Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva was a Tana. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a Tana. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was a Tana. An Amoira means an expounder of the Mishnah, somebody who explained the Mishnah. So there's a demarcation point. Until the Mishnah, all the great sages from the time of Hillel and on were called Tanoim, T-A-N-N-A-I-M, Tanoim, or the Tanaic period. The sages after the Mishnah were called the Amoraim, A-M-O-R-I-A-M, those who expounded the Mishnah. And there's a difference in the way they are called. A Tana is called Rebbe, something, Resh Bet Yud. Rebbe, Yehuda HaNasi. Rebbe, Shimon Bar Yochai. Rebbe, Akiva. An Amora is called Rav, something or other. Rav, Shimon. Rav, Ushmuel. And so on and so forth. A difference in name. I want to tell you that after the Mishnah was written, it was universally accepted. A new vistas opened up in the Jewish world. Now that the green light had been given to write things down, everybody started writing things down. There were things that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi left out of the Mishnah. These were put in additional works. Tosefta means an additional word. Beraisa. The word Beraisa means outside of. It's an Aramaic word. However, the Talmud, which was, as we'll speak about next week, quotes, starts off with a Mishnah, and then says, yeah, but we've learnt in a Beraisa differently. Okay? So we'll discuss differences between Mishnah and Beraisa. The Mishnah is very concise. Thereafter, there was a tremendous amount more. But once he'd written the Mishnah, the gateways were open, and we can say that it was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi who took one of the most significant decisions in Jewish history, because he actually paved the way for the oral tradition now to become in the written form, and ever since then, the Jews have been learning the Mishnah, studying all its commentaries as put forward in the Talmud, and then as ruled in the code of Jewish law, and still today in the Jewish community today, the final rule of law is the code of Jewish law. You remember I started off with Hillel? Perhaps we can go and finish off with a latter-day Hillel. In fact, 13 generations after the first Hillel, there was another Hillel. He was called Hillel Hasheni, the second Hillel, and he did a very important thing. Very important thing. Until that time in history, the Jewish calendar had been fixed by the Sanhedrin, by the leader of the generation, and had been done by citation of the new moon. How did they know when Rosh Chodesh was, when the first day of the month was? Because Edim, witnesses, came and say they saw the new moon. And they ran to Jerusalem, or wherever it was, and the Beth Din proclaimed, this is Rosh Chodesh. Of course, it's very important to know when Rosh Chodesh is in the month of Tishrei, because that's Rosh Hashanah. It's very important to know when Rosh Chodesh is on Nisan, because 14 days later is Pesach. These are very important things. Hillel Hasheni came along and fixed a calendar. In other words, he says, no longer are we going to rely on citation of witnesses, because no longer do we have proficiency in this area, I am going to fix a calendar. Now the Jewish calendar, quick 1 minute on the calendar. The solar year has 365 days, the lunar year 354 days, a discrepancy of 11 days. Every 3 years you can reconcile. However, you're left 33 days, correct? You've got 33 days to deal with, which overlap every 3 years. So even if you make a leap year, every 3 years, you still got a discrepancy of 3 days. So what Hillel Hasheni did is he fixed a Jewish calendar of a 19-year cycle where there'd be 7 leap years in those 19 years. And that was fixed for time immemorial. So now we can predict, you can know when, you want to know when the Rosh Hashanah is in the year 2005? No problem, I can tell you, look in the calendar, I can tell you. When was that done? In the days of Hillel Hasheni. What did that do? We do have the Metzius of where sometimes you have not full, new moon. You have a new moon. You can have a new moon slightly before. It could be one day before the actual Rosh Chodesh, but it usually comes out to then. What did that do? If you think about it, that took the independence away from the land of Israel and placed it in the land of, in the lap of every Jewish community. And what happened at that time, as the Romans were making almost an end of the Yishuv in Israel, when the sages in Israel were becoming less and less important, the sages of Babylon were becoming much more important, and we'll discuss next week the development of the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. Let's finish off this week by saying in the many years, in the many years after the finishing of the Mishnah, a tremendous amount of discussion around the Mishnah, stories, anecdotes, lore, etc., was collected by the sages in the land of Israel and edited by a man called Reb Yochanan ben Napcha, simply known as Reb Yochanan, and he edited a book which we know today as the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, or the Talmud, it's often called the Palestinian Talmud, I hate that word, but it's the Talmud de Bnei Ma'arava, the Talmud of the people in the West. In other words, the Babylonians called it the Talmud of the people in the West because they meant the Israeli Talmud, okay? Now that was a commentary on 39 of the 63 tractates of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is split up into six orders and 63 tractates. And it's also written with quite some brevity. And not, I don't, to my knowledge, there is not today an English translation of that Talmud. Much more important, and something which we study day in, day out, is of course the Babylonian Talmud, which we'll come to study next week, developed by the sages in Babylon. What we have done this week, though, is spoken about the people who compiled the oral law, Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, Judah the Prince, who transcribed it, and all this has taken place over a period of great destruction, great persecution. And we've seen that phenomenon, that although politically the Jews were in absolute shambles, and although financially, economically, and socially the Jewish world was broken, at the seeds of survival were planted and cultivated through education, through studying, and through learning. And that is a very powerful lesson to us, that although we may be greatly despondent in any given situation about the social, economical, behavioral structure of the people, one thing we cannot forget is that our ultimate survival, as has been displayed in history from time immemorial, has been through education.